Greetings from the podcast where you don't have to smash any like buttons or send us a review. Just listen. This is the Paleo Protestant podcast with the three historians from Hillsdale College. My colleagues, Corey Moss, Miles Smith, and myself, DG Hart. And we're here this time to talk about what does it mean to be a good confessional Protestant? Specifically, what does it mean to be a good Anglican? What does it mean to be a good Lutheran? What does it mean to be a good Presbyterian? I have some interest in this, not only for concerns of my own piety, and but also Presbyterians are adjacent to those hot Protestants, Puritans, and hot Protestants set the bar pretty high sometimes, and for what it means to be a good Christian. And oftentimes look down, which is a sin, but they look down on Lutherans and Anglicans for not being sufficiently hot. So we could talk about that. But before we get into the subject, I thought we might also let listeners into the seminar room a little bit and what we may or may not be teaching. Each of us at the history department teaches the Western Heritage course, which runs from Hammurabi to John Locke, roughly. And it's a sprint through a lot of material, but I thought we might talk just briefly how it's going, what you're covering, and even if you've gotten to Christianity yet, which I have, but, who wants to go first?
Why don't you go, Daryl? You're the pace horse here. So,
well, I covered Jesus and the apostles yesterday, and had some, fun probably isn't the right word, but trying to remind students of how bizarre Christianity is, this idea of a resurrection of a dead man, this idea of an ascension of a formerly dead man. That was part of it, but also then I do have a Jewish student. I don't know if she's observant, but she's actually an Israeli. And, you know, that kind of gave me a little bit of a leash to think about how provocative Jesus, Paul, other, just the general Christian message was to Jews who were serious. Paul obviously knew that, understood that when he was Saul. So that was, for me, that makes history kind of sparkle when you can get, make it unsettling in some way, not in a Socrates destroying the faith of the youth in Athens way. Although I guess we are recording. I guess maybe I should be careful if any of the administrators here at Hillsdale listen to this, which I doubt, but that's where I am right now.
Well, your sprint is pretty impressive. I'm still jogging. So you're two chapters ahead of me. We are just in the early stages of the Roman Republic, not even the Roman Empire. So we're talking about, kind of nice timing. We're talking about piety and the way Polybius talks about what helps to account for the strength and the success and the rapid rise of the Roman Republic. In the reading that we have, he ends by saying, but I think the most important thing above and beyond the constitution and the customs and the mores is their piety, is their religion. And so I think that's one of the things that students find a little bit odd, that they're perfectly comfortable thinking about, you know, the Hebraic religion and, you know, creation ex nihilo and monotheism and man and woman made in the image of God. Obviously, that's important for the history of Western civilization. And certainly the Christian religion. But I think they're a little surprised to find out that the Romans were convinced that what made them great was their own religion and their piety.
Yeah. Good.
Well, I'm splitting the difference. I am in the middle of the Roman Empire. And we were talking about impiety today. We were talking about Suetonius and Nero in particular.
Oh, yeah.
All of his impieties. And
the apostle killer.
Yeah, that's right. The Paul Slayer. That sounds kind of disrespectful. I meant it, not necessarily a fun way. But yeah, so what's interesting is that the Romans really had this idea that you, even the guys who were kind of percolating around the Republic and or in the Empire and sort of made their peace with the Principate, they're kind of still believers that some sort of piety is necessary. And obviously Suetonius is kind of giving you a word picture of what will happen if you aren't pious. You'll descend into moral decadence, the likes of which you've never seen. And so he uses a lot of really kind of grotesque examples from the life of Nero in his short sort of vignette biography that includes there in the 12 Caesars. So,
well, that's probably a good transition into talking about this subject. And is there just a kind of human premise, outlook, assumption that the good life follows from some kind of piety, at least for a large swath of human beings? And there's a Roman kind, there's a Greek kind, there's a Hebrew kind, and then there's a Christian Protestant kind. And I mean, that may be too skeptical of a way of approaching this, but I mean, I do continue to wonder, since I am an officer in a congregation, and you know, we don't have anybody under discipline. We don't bring people up on discipline. Calvin would be ashamed of us, probably. And how could the Orthodox Presbyterian Church ever be lax, which is also an indication that I'm not sure there's a widespread understanding in our communion of what it means to be a good Presbyterian. I mean, I do think we would like to see everybody go to morning and evening services on Sunday and have some kind of Sabbath observance. And I don't know if that's particularly hot when it comes to piety. And then beyond that, I think people do consider family worship and whether parents are leading in worship at home, which includes catechesis. But I mean, if you, these days, it seems, if you get that out of church members, man, you've hit a grand slam. But I, you know, do Lutherans have an understanding of what it means? I mean, a common understanding, is there a kind of consensus as well as among Anglicans on some of this?
Yeah, no, this is a good question. And in some respects, I don't know if I'm the right guy to ask, because, you know, I went through seminary and, you know, a lot of my friends are Lutheran pastors. And so I might have a kind of skewed perspective of what's normal, what's anticipated, what's perhaps expected. But as an entree, at least, I would say this. One of the most consistent complaints in any Lutheran church, and this is certainly not unique to Lutherans, but again, it's an entree, is that the number of people that are on the books as members is always at least twice the number as are present on any given Sunday. And then the number present on any given Sunday is probably, in most congregations, five times the number of those who are in, you know, adult Bible study or Sunday school. So there's a kind of twofold lament. One is that, you know, at least half of those who are kind of Lutherans, to the extent that they are members of this congregation, just aren't regularly in service. Now, might not be the same people who are absent every Sunday, or else that they would be under some sort of discipline. But 50% missing is significant. But then the absences at Bible class or Sunday school, that just that is a consistent lament among certainly among pastors, but also among lay people. You know, don't you want to know more about Scripture, about your Lutheran confession, about X, Y, and Z? And you know, it's entirely possible that many people are getting this elsewhere, you know, in their own devotions at home, their own study at home. But just as an observation, this is a common lament. So a pretty kind of low bar. If you show up regularly to services and Bible study, we think you're pretty pious.
And before you jump in, Miles, just since you're the historian, we're all historians, but you're also a historian of Lutheranism. And do you think this is those numbers would be different, say, 50, 100 years ago?
Yes. And 50 or 100 years ago, our day school system. So this is probably a big difference compared both to American Presbyterianism and the Anglican Church in America. You know, the LCMS has pretty much from the beginning had this extensive system of primary schools and high schools. And for a very, very long time, I mean, I don't know that anyone came right out and said this, but it was considered, you know, impious to not send your kids to the congregational school, you know, to send them to the local public school. So not only would people be in service on Sunday and be in Sunday school, but they would also have religious instruction through the week in the day school, and they would be singing hymns every morning. So yeah, there's a big difference from my understanding between what's normal, what's acceptable, what's considered pious now, and what might have been the case 50 years ago, certainly 100 years ago.
I mean, it's curious to say that. I'm just going to insert here quickly, Miles, before you go, that was the case and is still the case in certain Orthodox Presbyterian congregations because of the influence and presence of Dutch Reformed in our circles, people like Cornelius van Til and Ned Stonehouse and R.B. Kuyper in the original faculty at Westminster Seminary. But there was a sense, both in the CRC when Ann and I were in the Christian Reformed Church and then at our Glenside, Pennsylvania congregation, suburbs of Philadelphia, that supported, very strongly supported a local Christian day school, that if you were sending your kids to public schools, you were doing something wrong. And this is an ethnic Protestant thing because American Presbyterians, as part of the Anglo-American complex of British Protestantism, you know, the public schools, you had Bible, you had prayer until the 60s. This was the way you assimilate the immigrants. This was kind of God and country in a small way. So what could possibly be wrong with the public schools for, again, that's that slice. I mean, maybe in the 19th century, there was more efforts of Christian day school, but that would have also probably been the result of not having public schools so widely available or required. But anyway, that's a good reminder of that piece of at least one narrow slice of Presbyterian past. But Miles, what's your understanding of the Anglican piety?
So I think that, I mean, you know, so much of Anglicans, I mean, there's a real bifurcation between the Episcopal Church and ACNA on this. They're really different. The Episcopal Church, the conservative ones, most of which are now ACNA, I think we're probably mapped pretty similarly on to the LCMS. I think you have a lot of cultural, and I don't think that's necessarily terrible. Like you have a lot of people who just very dutifully and culturally, you know, came to Episcopal parishes, and mom and dad and granddad and grandmother had gone there. And so there's a lot of that. I think the unique thing with ACNA is it's so bifurcated. You have some tiny parishes, and there'll be like 15 people in the books, and they're just hanging on, and, you know, they got killed out by bad leadership. while they were in the Episcopal Church. The other side of it is, my parish is an example. You have a lot of parishes where there's probably twice as many people in the pews as are every Sunday as are on the books. And my church is one of those. There are not that many members. I think maybe, and that, you know, this isn't counting children. I think at one point recently we had maybe 75 or 80 members, and there's probably 130 people, 140 people in worship every Sunday. And so, well, I think the reason for that is because Anglicanism, because it's the safe kind of liturgical, sacramental, Protestant option for the searcher types, right? Because Lutherans, they won't let you take communion, and Catholicism's just out, you know, out altogether. So you can go and kind of do your exploring at Anglican churches. So I think what happens is you have a lot more revolving door Anglicans than you probably have revolving door Lutherans, or even perhaps revolving door Presbyterians, although that happens sometimes too. That Anglicanism, I think, is much more, it's in practice been looser in kind of its policing of the table. And so I think that's led us to kind of be the kind of destination of choice for young evangelicals who are kind of, you know, searching.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why you have, especially in college towns, large Anglican churches. I think this bears out. Yeah, I think there's a sizable one in Wheaton. Our church is actually fairly sizable for our diocese. College towns tend to be good for Anglican churches, especially if they have a lot of Christian students. And ours does, obviously. So ACNA is pretty bifurcated. You do have the interesting phenomena of having quite a few parishes where there are way more attendees than there are on the books.
So do you have Sunday school, Bible classes, and what kind of participation do you get for that?
We do. So we get really good participation right now. So what we do is, this is pretty typical. This is an old TEC kind of formulary that I think worked for a long time. You do a spoken word Eucharist at 8 o'clock or 8:30 in the morning. Then you have Christian education, and then you have service again at 10:30. And so what we do is, we have a class right now on the 39 articles. That's Christian education. That's probably really good. That definitely raises hackles. I think a lot of those kind of revolving door Anglicans, especially if they hear a good explanation of the articles, are probably going to be surprised that, you know, oh, they're not Anglo-Catholic and they're not necessarily evangelical. They're sort of, you know, Episcopal Calvinistic, as it were. And so we have a very capable layperson teaching it right now. And so I think in that sense, that's been good. I mean, it's been a rich Sunday morning environment in that sense. And so, yeah, we do have Sunday school, two services. We're kind of outgrowing our two services, so we'll be interested to see how we can do. But that's not unusual in college towns. I mean, college towns typically treat Anglicanism really well.
So do your traditions, communions, local settings do much with worship during the week, whether in the home or services at church? Or, I mean, the great thing about going to England is you can find, at least in the cities, Church of England parishes that have evensong, even if it's, and you can find it in some cathedrals in the States. I may have mentioned this in a previous recording that my wife and I were at a AARSBL meeting, which always runs right up against Thanksgiving. So we were in San Francisco for the meetings, American Academy of Religion and Society of Biblical Literature, for the people who don't know those initials. And San Francisco then was a just a glorious city. It still isn't in many respects. And we were going from there up to the wine country. So we were spending a couple nights in San Francisco in between the conference and Thanksgiving weekend. And so we were going to the cathedral, which is a pretty wacky place. I mean, there's a long history of some strange bishops in San Francisco. Among them, what was his name? The guy, Pike, was that? Wasn't he there?
Oh, was he San Francisco?
I don't remember that.
The famous Joan Didion essay about him in towards Bethlehem.
Right. But we were going to even evening prayer, and the priest woman went ahead and said it, even though Ann and I were the only two people there. And I wonder if she would have said it even without anyone there. I mean, she's worshiping as well. But I mean, the Anglicans have this in their prayer book for weekday morning and evening services. You know, and then there are other, Miles, you've instructed us, I think, at different times about other parts of the prayer book that can be used at home, even though if you're not having a priest lead the service at the parish. But is there a kind of embarrassment in Anglican communion if you're not having evening song, evening prayer?
So we do midweek a lot of, I mean, I remember this just in Charleston and Fort Worth, there was always Tuesday. There was a Tuesday morning or a Wednesday morning. And by morning, that could be noontime as well, Eucharist. And then you would typically, they would have morning prayer on either side of that and evening prayer. So we typically do, we do a midweek service on Wednesday. It's typically noon, Eucharist at noon. So that's pretty typical. Morning prayer, we do that pretty regularly during the summer. And so we do that in the morning and then in the evening. And that's typically, that was Wednesday and or Thursday. So weekday services, we've kind of reconstituted them. Some of it, as churches get bigger, I think they can justify them more easily. So we do midweek services, and most cathedrals will have two midweek services.
Mm-hmm.
For Holy Communion, and then they'll do two. So it's kind of staggered almost, morning prayer during the week, and then you also have Holy Communion. So,
but for people who don't come to those, do you think, is there any kind of expectation or hope that people will be worshiping at home using what's in the prayer book that's available, or even, and the cycle of readings, or even just, you know?
Yeah, I don't have kids. So this is anecdotal, what I'm told by people do with kids. A lot of times they do the evening prayer, the shorter form evening prayer, right, with their kids. Some people do the whole thing.
Hmm.
It takes about 25 or 30 minutes. And so in our parish, I think the expectation is families do evening prayer pretty regularly. I don't have children. So it's just me.
So if we drive by your house and the shades are up, we're not going to see you chanting even song.
That's right. Chanting to myself in the mirror. I think there is an expectation in our parish, Daryl. I don't know how, obviously ACTNUM maps onto so many different, some people are very evangelical. And so, you know, they would rather have some sort of a music worship service. Anglo-Catholics tend to find liturgy for everything. And so I think we try to be, I guess, what you'd call a fairly normative Anglican parish. And I think the expectation, at least for a lot of our people, is they will be doing at least evening prayer at home.
Corey, what about?
Yeah. It's very typical in an LCMS congregation that in addition to the Sunday service, there's a midweek service, typically Wednesday. This will almost always be the case, especially during Advent and Lent. So even if you're at a parish that doesn't normally have a midweek service, during the festival seasons of Advent and Lent, you certainly will. And then, although it's not so typical in most parishes, very, very typical, back to Miles' point about college towns, that there are morning services like matins. So, you know, a friend of mine that does campus ministry in the Pittsburgh area, he's at a large historic parish in downtown Pittsburgh, and either he or the other pastor say matins every morning, and very often with nobody there. You know, it might be that, you know, there are ladies coming in to set up for a funeral luncheon later in the day. A couple of them will pop in.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that.
Yeah, some students will pop in. But yeah, it's just a rhythm that they're in. And, you know, like Miles says, it takes 20, 25 minutes. So it's not like it takes a lot of preparation. There won't be a sermon preached. There will just be the service and, you know, whatever the prayers are for the day. Here at Hillsdale, I mean, I think we should mention this. Since we have this plethora of student religious societies, you know, the Lutheran Society, the Anglican Fellowship, the Orthodox and Catholic societies, I mean, our chapel is booked pretty solid.
Right.
So I know that the Lutherans students do matins every morning, Compline every night. I think the Anglicans also do a morning and an evening service. Now, that's not the sort of thing that most churches sponsor. But to your second question, there is an expectation that if you are not going to an evening service midweek, or on those days of the week that there just aren't services at the congregation, that you are doing something at home. And so probably, you know, 50 years ago, this would be reading one of the daily offices from the hymnal. So, you know, matins in the morning, evening prayer, compline in the evening. I don't know how long this goes back, but our denominational publishing house just cranks out lots of volumes of devotional literature. Hmm. So, you know, it's a compilation of, you know, one page excerpts from sermons from, you know, Luther or C.F.W. Walther or the church fathers. And they'll just be, you know, tagged to the days of the year. And I think it's fairly safe to say that publishers don't print stuff if there's not a market for it.
Yeah.
So the fact that we keep cranking this out, I think, is a pretty good indication that there's a market for it, that people are actually using these things. Our own local pastor has actually been very good in our monthly newsletter. He's been doing kind of little reviews of some of this literature, you know, explaining what's out there, what might be helpful for couples or for, you know, families with young kids. I think that's kind of an expectation. In fact, one of these resources, it's called the Treasury of Daily Prayer. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of code language. You know, you'll hear somebody drop that, oh, you know, that reminds me of what we read in the Treasury this morning. And you hear the "we" because there's this expectation that, well, of course you read that this morning too, didn't you? So yeah.
So is there any, I mean, Lutherans would have been on the sidelines of, again, American, Anglo-American Protestantism, but there's a long history in evangelical, but going back to mainline as well, of prayer meetings, midweek prayer meeting. Is that, and Episcopal Church, I think, would have done that too, in some ways, depending on how low church they were. And of course, there's the famous prayer meeting revival of 1859, and the cottage that Anne and I have in Asbury Grove, north of Boston, is started with that prayer meeting revival, where people would actually go to a camp meeting as well as part of the revival. And you know, we still have a religious program there, and a chaplain in the summer, etc. But do Lutherans have prayer meetings? And it's okay if they don't, because prayer meetings can be really weird.
So this is, to my knowledge, just not part of, you know, the historical Lutheran tradition. However, as you may know, in I think the 60s and into the 70s, parts of the LCMS had this brief flirtation, as did most other American denominations, with the charismatic movement. And so there was about a generation in which some parishes would have something like a prayer meeting. Huh. In fact, the congregation I first attended when we first moved to Michigan, I learned much later that that had been one of the struggles of a previous pastor. Yeah. That when he took the call to be the pastor of that congregation, there was this group that had been for years organizing, I don't know if it was a Saturday evening thing or what, but a prayer meeting in the church basement. And as in, you know, kind of the old pietist tradition, there was a sense that this kind of took priority over, you know, actual Sunday morning divine service. Yeah. So Sunday morning, we're just kind of going through the motions, saying the same thing, hearing the same law gospel sermon. But, you know, the Saturday night prayer meeting is where kind of real piety takes place. Right. So that was what I know one of his struggles was to sort of correct that impression.
Well, speaking of that, let me just go to our sponsor this recording with sponsor is Christianity Today.
Whoa.
Christianity Today is more than a magazine. As a nonprofit global media ministry, Christianity Today engages over 4 million Christian leaders every month, encouraging and equipping them to advocate for the church and shape the evangelical conversation. Trusted, thoughtful, balanced, CT's breadth of content brings critical, important issues to the forefront and offers practical solutions for church leaders. You can subscribe at three different levels, the digital, print, and digital, or just print. Print and digital costs only 75 cents more per month than either the digital or print-only subscriptions. This is journalism communicating the true, the good, and beautiful gospel. So run to CT Magazine and subscribe today. So if Corey, going back to what you just said, there is a sense of how, and this came up yesterday in Heritage, actually, where Jesus is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, when you pray, don't pray like the hypocrites do, who want to be seen, fasting, etc. There's this great distinction, I think, that, you know, the Father who sees in secret will reward you according to what you sort of do in secret. But the hot Protestants often, and the Pietists in the Lutheran tradition or Lutheran world also, sort of emphasize things that were visible, and that this was more intense. These were places that if you attended these things or participated in these activities, then you really meant it. And if you merely go Sunday morning and even Sunday evening in the Presbyterian tradition, you don't necessarily mean it. You can't tell if you mean it, because everybody's doing, well, actually not everybody's doing it, but so is there much of a sense in among Anglicans and Lutherans, a worry if people really mean it?
I'll take a stab at this. and I'll waffle by saying
I've got an answer.
By saying yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, I think if we're honest, and even if we're not trying to be critical or judgmental, we do have this suspicion that some of the people sitting in the pew next to us are there because it's a social or familial expectation. You know, my grandfather helped build this church, and my father was a lifelong member of the board of trustees, and they would roll over in their grave if I was not here with my kids on Sunday morning. And so I'm here, but I'm not at Bible study. I'm not at midweek services, et cetera, et cetera. And now I hope that is, the totally wrong impression, but I do. I think some people worry about that. On the other hand, I think it's not a great concern for one very simple reason. The firm Lutheran emphasis on the efficaciousness of the word. So we can kind of say to ourselves, I don't care why the guy in the pew is here this Sunday and every Sunday. The fact that he's here means that he is hearing the gospel, and the word of the Lord does not return to him empty. So I'm all in favor of, hypocrites and cultural Christians and lukewarm Christians being, for the time being, kind of lukewarm, going through the motions, because it's better than the alternative, which is staying home and not hearing the gospel. So I think we do worry about it a little bit, but then we try to remind ourselves that this is not the thing to worry about.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I saw online, kind of two different separate tribes within the Calvinist tradition kind of going at each other. And one of the things that I remember from my childhood is there's a lot of concern about amongst hot Protestants, so Puritan, whatever you want to call them, about is your faith a living faith? Like this language of living faith. Because if it's not living, then you're probably not a Christian, right?
You're dead.
Yeah, you're dead. And so I think that's just something that's an articulation that's completely absent within the Anglican tradition. You just don't have people looking over your shoulder and say, are you living? I think because the paradigm is kind of reductionistic. Like there's a lot of people who show up in Anglican churches who are just like Corey said, grandma went here, but they're really faithful, like in their little circle. Like, they probably would never talk about their faith to you, but like somebody in their family has been showing up for 400 years to set out coffee. And like, that person, Corey, like our listeners can, you're smiling because we both know that person, right? Like we know that old lady who, like, I've never had a substantive conversation with her, but she's there every Sunday and she just does her little part. And so I think that on some level, there's a real sense that, the liturgy and the sacraments, if you're doing those, it's probably not my job to try to look any further. That's probably the Holy Spirit's job. I just don't know how much of a concern that is. I mean, I think for Anglicans, like public scandal has always been kind of the standard. Are you not causing public scandal? Okay, well then there's not a big reason for me to sort of dissect your salvific state. And so I think there's a sort of almost, it's not a revivalistic demand among the hot. Well, maybe it is a revivalistic demand. It's like, are you really saved? Do you really have an alive faith? And my answer is, I don't know. I'm a sinner a lot of times. I feel kind of dead a lot of times. God, I hope you're not asking sort of the qualitative condition of my faith. And so I think Anglicans definitely leave it at that. I know every rector I've ever had has just been very reluctant to sort of get into that thing. A lot of them will just say, well, read the word, read the prayer book. And so there's not that kind of dissection that's going on. And that seems to be maybe the big difference between hot Protestants. And I don't even think every Presbyterian is a hot Protestant in that regard. And maybe Anglicans and Lutherans.
Well, I would add one more thing, and I'll step on toes, perhaps first my own. I mean, there is, and I suspect in Anglicanism as well, since Lutheranism and Anglicanism like have a script to follow on right. Sunday morning.
Failing. Maybe the script does make us a little bit less pious.
Well, I think that on the one hand, you've got those that we typically associate with a kind of lower church piety who try to supplement that with, you know, the prayer meeting or the small group or whatever it is. But because the script doesn't require things like, you know, bowing every time the Trinity is invoked or crossing yourself at certain points during the service, there is on the higher side of things, those who will say, well, you know, just reading the script isn't enough. Mm. You know, I look around and I know who's not who's really saved, but who's really Lutheran because they're crossing themselves and they're bowing.
So-and-so didn't bow at the cross this morning. Do they really care?
Yeah. Right.
Their kids don't bow. Like, oh no, this is a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I say this just kind of as an observation. I mean, I like that stuff. I'm not bothered by people who don't do it. I'm not bothered by people who do one or two extra things that I don't do. But I think there is perhaps a kind of temptation, both on the sort of lower church evangelical side of Lutheranism and on the higher church, more liturgical side of Lutheranism, to think that these supplemental things might be some indication of a deeper piety.
And I think history bears that out in Anglican, in the history of the Church of England in particular, because it was evangelicals who felt like, you know, the liturgy is not enough. And guys like John Henry Newman are the ones who turned into Anglo-Catholics and then to Roman Catholics, right? Because the idea was the liturgy is not enough. You need to be doing more. You know, your soul is not incorporated enough. Your body's not incorporated enough. Are you really, you know, a Christian? And so there's kind of a unique corner that gets rounded there. And I think definitely, I mean, you know, you see that there's always this concern of, well, are your kids crossing themselves? You know, you literally, I'm up at the altar a lot of times. And so I literally look at and parents will be moving their kids' hands. And I don't know if this happens in Lutheran churches, but I've definitely seen Anglican churches. They'll be like, they'll reach out. Well, did you cross yourself? And I'm like, does it matter if your 5-year-old didn't cross themselves? You know? So I think, yeah, there's excesses from both sides. I think this is a great point that Corey brings up, because if one of the things, if you're new, inevitably, if I see a new person, I know they're from an evangelical background, it'll be a student. They're looking around the whole time. They're not reading the prayer book. They're looking around the whole time to sort of figure out, okay, when do we cross ourselves? When do we bow and all that stuff? And you realize that just doesn't matter. But it is another sort of, dare I say, addition to the law, right, that gets added on that you have to do to be a real Anglican or a real Lutheran.
I'll share an anecdote, and I don't mean to throw Anglicans under the bus here, but when I first arrived in Oxford, there was no Lutheran parish. And so the idea was, okay, well, I'll go to the evangelical Anglican parish where I know I'll hear good gospel preaching on one week, and I'll suffer through the sort of evangelical service with the drums and the guitars. And then the next week I'll go to a high Anglican parish where I can enjoy the liturgy and just kind of daydream during the sermon, because that's probably not going to be very good. And one of the high services that I went to, I mean, aesthetically, it was perhaps the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen.
Huh.
It was like watching, you know, like synchronized swimming or ballet or something. I mean, there were probably, in addition to the priest and his assistant priest, like 5 or 6 other people up there robed, and they all turned you know, at the same direction, at the same time, like they were doing military drills in the Marine Corps. And it was absolutely beautiful. Sermon was, in fact, atrocious. I'm not sure that Jesus was ever mentioned. But I attended there a couple of times and realized this is what's important to them, kind of getting these minute details right. And you know, the biblical stuff that you're reading in the service and preaching on in the service, less important. I don't think that's the way most Anglican churches are, most Lutheran churches, but that jumped out at me as a kind of stark, extreme example.
Yeah. I mean, one barometer in corporate congregational worship that I've reflected on sometimes as a marker, a sign of someone's faith and piety is singing the hymns. I mean, it's a remarkable thing that people sing, because we don't see that much. I mean, you kind of maybe sing in the shower, you sing in the car with the radio, but to actually open up a book and sing from that book and sing these words that are really quite glorious sometimes. Mm. And you know, if you wonder about someone in the congregation who you think, they don't seem like the greatest Christian, but there they are. And it's not if they're belting it out, if they're just singing, because it'd be very easy to stand up and have the book open but not sing if you chose not to. This is what happens to me when Ann and I go to a contemporary service. I don't sing because I usually don't know the music. I don't know the tune. They don't give me any music that I can follow anyway, because I can read music a little bit. And of course, I'm also kind of being a jerk and not participating because I don't like the music. But something as ordinary, seemingly, in Christian worship as singing is really very different from the way that a lot of people think about practicing the faith. And, you know, you can then add a gloss of how many times scripture talks about singing praise to God and how central song is, irrespective of the Psalter, how central it is in a Christian's devotion. So, you know, that's a really kind of subtle thing. And I actually talked to Leon Cass. I'm going to drop a name here. Ethicist, physician, writer of many books. He was the president of the chair of President Bush's commission on medical ethics or something like that. But he has a great book on the hungry soul, thinking about what it means that humans eat and the way that we eat, using hands, sitting up at tables, etc. It's really very smart. But I was able to talk to him once at a conference reception and said he needed to do something like that with song. What does it say about human beings that we can sing and sing the way that we do? Of course, there are a lot of critters, especially birds, that do sing. But I still don't have a very good answer to this, but it does seem like there's something fairly remarkable about human beings that we can sing, period.
And I think that this, I mean, speaking of piety, I think one of the things that the Reformation discovered or rediscovered is that song is a very effective way of inculcating and strengthening piety. It's difficult for a lot of us to just memorize words, but you put them to a tune, and sometimes you can't get them out of your head. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very effective means of catechesis.
Well, I need to bring this to a close because I have to go to a session meeting, actually. But I do at some point think we should talk about congregational song and hymns and the like. We all have different traditions in a way. that represent this. And something else that we probably could talk about another episode or recording is vocation, because and with a Lutheran in the room, how can you not talk about vocation? But it seems like that's also another really important missing piece of thinking about piety. I know it's informed my own. Yes, it does free me from having to go to prayer meetings, conceivably, but I do think that there's something about serving God during the week in our various callings that is actually an important part of our devotion. But again, it doesn't have that spiritual dimension to it that is easy to see in a way. So maybe that's something we can talk about. But we'll say so long to now to our listeners, whoever they may be. And if you do have suggestions for comments, be sure to tweet at Miles, who is at Ivy Miles Smith. Is that Ivy?
Just at Ivy Miles.
Ivy Miles. And yeah. Then I am at Old Life, and I guess Dr. Moss is still holding out.
He's still resisting.
He's still lurking, but he's not there officially. So thank you for listening. Thanks, guys, for talking, and we'll talk again soon, God willing.
All right, thanks.
Take care. Thanks.